With more American households renting now than any point in the last 50 years, some Illinois lawmakers say it's time to get rid of the state's ban on rent control. Plus, can foregoing a daily latte really put you on a better financial footing? It's just some of the advice women are calling out. Today, a more nuanced conversation about women and money. And Chicago Cubs shortstop Addison Russell is back on the field after his suspension for domestic violence. Some fans aren't happy.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, why some advocates are saying it's time for Illinois to lift its ban on rent control. And Cubs infielder Addison Russell is back from his suspension after domestic violence charges. Some fans are not happy. First, we're going to spend some time talking about women and personal finance and some of the ways gender can keep people out of this conversation. We were inspired by a Twitter conversation around saving and sexism, specifically a tweet that Chase Bank had kind of a mansplaining vibe of telling people how to save money by eating leftovers instead of eating out. Then a new financial advice book came out called The Latte Factor that offered advice for women on how to save. Buy less frivolous things like coffee drinks and keep more cash in your purse. The backlash was pretty fierce. Writer Sally Krawcheck astutely summed this up in her response in an article in Fast Company, and we'll tweet that out. But it got me and our producers thinking about why many banks and financial experts still don't know how to speak to women about money. So that's what we're going to do right now. Here's what Melissa said yesterday when we were talking about this topic. Melissa said this to us on Twitter. I want to see realistic budgeting articles written by women and people who understand what it's really like out there. Basics of finance and investing that aren't condescending or scolding. Advice for women also on navigating the workplace that's more than just you have to take initiative or just ask for a raise, because that completely disregards systemic bias against women. Keep tweeting your thoughts to 21STShow and we'll read them during the hour. Joining me now is Annie Logue, a lecturer at the University of Illinois at Chicago and author of a number of books in the Four Dummies series about finances, including Day Trading for Dummies. Katie Leiprandt is a certified financial planner and the managing director of Baldwin Financial Advisors. She's on the line from Arlington Heights in the suburbs of Chicago. And Bobby Kincaid is president of Central Illinois' Heart of Illinois chapter of Better Investing. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Annie, I wonder first we can just talk about this latte that's been so demonized and maybe just talk about the fact that just cutting back on frills, like spending a $4 drink a day, how much does that really make a dent in our financial health?
It depends. Being frugal about certain things is never bad financial advice. And I think particularly for people who have high levels of personal debt or credit card debt, which has very high interest rates, or for people who are not getting the full employer match on their 401k plan. For people in those situations, very small increases in savings, like the kind you would get from cutting out a latte or a movie night or whatever it is that you spend money on, those contributions can add up. I think in a more general sense, though, some of the issues are far broader than just people are spending too much money on things like lattes. And I think that that's where some of the backlash to the Chase tweets and a lot of the positive response to Sally Krawcheck's article is coming from.
Mm-hmm. And we should add, and one of the things Sally's article pointed out is there are major systemic ways in which women are prevented from getting the same economic freedom as men. When we talk about the pink tax, which is that, for example, women pay more for items that men use as well, the wage gap, the debt gap, paid leave. We've talked about many of these things on the program. That is not insignificant. Annie, when we're looking also at investing in personal finance, do you think it's fair to say there's also a gap when it comes to that as well?
I think there is, and I think there is for a couple of reasons. And again, some of these are very cultural. One is that the financial field is dominated by men, and in our society, money is a way that men keep score. Money is a way that people keep score in our society. But I think that this makes it, to a lot of men, this is a very macho thing, that they should be good at money and that maybe the little lady isn't quite as smart. But I also think that there are some biases that go way back to the way math is taught in this country, and that's a soapbox I could go on for hours. But a lot of women feel intimidated by math, and they're okay with it. That it's okay in our culture for a woman to say that she can't balance a checkbook, even though it would be mortifying for that same woman to say that she doesn't know how to read a newspaper. So I think that we need to increase awareness of math, that it is not something that is as difficult as it's made out to be. It is something that any person with average intelligence can learn and not be afraid by that. So I do think that there are some things that women, some cultural biases that both men and women bring to the discussion that add to the gap.
Kate, I wonder if you think financial institutions, when we're thinking about banks or retirement companies, do you think that these institutions also view women differently?
Absolutely. And I personally seen that. Did you say Kate?
I did. Oh, sorry. Is this okay? Kate, why don't you start, and then Bobby, if that's you can weigh in after. Go ahead, Kate.
Okay, great. So I've experienced this personally as well. You know, I would just on my day off when I'm wearing casual clothing go into the bank, and you know, I've run this financial services company for 30 years plus, and I'll ask just some question. And the answers that I get are not respectful of my knowledge, and they're more mansplaining, they're very remedial, and I understand they don't know that I know anything, but I think it's different than if my husband would come in with me and he asks.
And they don't know you're a certified financial planner, Kate?
Exactly. They don't know who I am. And he asks the same question, and they say, well, let's sit down and we'll go through the numbers with you. And with me, I'm just kind of, put off with a very simple answer. And I think that comes from, 84% of our executive roles in financial services are held by men. So you see men everywhere. When I walk into a room of certified financial planners, 23% of us are women. So about 80% of everyone in the room is men. And they do speak to you differently. And I do see, and I did a talk on this, what women want and why you should care for a financial services professional group. And so it's men and women. And in that group, there were quite a few men who signed up. It went over pretty well. But what I said is you really need to, when you pick up the phone to call a family or when some couple comes in, ask the question in a unisex way, such as who handles the finances in the family? Who's more comfortable with that? And not just assume and speak to the husband or making a phone call, is Mr. Jones there? How about asking, is the person who handles the insurance in the family home? So that it's not immediately putting the woman in a box of not knowing what they're talking about.
Bobby?
Right. Yes. I've actually had personal experience in that the last two automobiles that my husband and I bought together, I actually am the person that bought the car. And the fact and the reason that happened is when we go to the dealership, the man is talking to my husband, kicking the tires, et cetera, et cetera. I'm the one that's doing the test driving. And when we sit down, he pushes the paper toward my husband, and my husband has to say, no, she's the one with the money. I'm just along for the ride. And the point is he had to say that, though. He had to tell the person, the salesman, that I was the one there to negotiate with. And so I was pretty successful in negotiating for my 2011 Chevrolet when I bought it, and then now again with my 2018 Kia. Both times, it was the sales pitch was leaning toward the man, but I was the one that actually was buying the car. my husband jokingly says she's the one with all the money. And that's probably partially true because of our working financial situation, et cetera, and the savings that we've done. But the point is, he had to say, no, she's the one.
He had to direct the conversation to you, Bobby. And I wonder if you can share a little bit more about you're the president of the Central Illinois chapter of Better Investing. Can you tell us what Better Investing is?
Better Investing is a nonprofit educational association that teaches people how to invest in the stock market and not be afraid of it. We use a tool to help us gauge what stock to buy and how much to pay for it. It's called the Stock Selection Guide, and it's not gambling. It's a concerted effort to learn about a company that you're interested in. Is it growing? And if it is, do you want to buy stock in it? And if you do want to buy stock in it, are you buying it at a fair price? So we have some mechanisms on this tool that help us come to that conclusion. And if it's not the right price or it's not a growing company, we pass it up because there are plenty of other companies that are growing and it can be bought at a reasonable price. We're looking to increase our portfolios by doubling it every 5 years.
Oh, wow.
That means you do the math, that's a 14.99 whatever percent growth. We say 15% growth in order to do that. So they like to do it in investment clubs, but you can certainly do it individually. Investment clubs, though, you have the advantage of having more than one person talk about it. You have the experiences of all of these people. A typical investment club will probably have maybe an average of 10 to 15 members.
Right. And you actually have, and I know, Bobby, you guys have there's a pretty famous group of women investors in your chapter, the Beardstown Ladies. Kate, I wonder if I could ask you, when we're thinking about groups like the Beardstown Ladies, there's actually research that says female investors outperform men, even though only one in five brokers are women. Kate, I wonder if I could ask you, are there ways in which women might excel with, are there other ways where we might think about ways that women might excel with money that we should be thinking about?
Sure. Women can excel with money just by participating, and really, instead of leaning on somebody else, we don't allow that in our practice. You know, where a woman would say, well, I'm not good at this. I say, well, you will be. So we ask them to take the reins. It's a very collaborative approach, which works well with women. Women like to make decisions through conversations and interactions, not just data without those conversations or just statistics. So we commit to communicating with both partners to the point of, if the gentleman would like to come in alone for the financial planning meeting, the family financial planning meeting, we don't allow that. So we do really insist upon having the female show up, and then we give simple tools to help each party understand what they need to do, what are the top three things they need to do to make headway in their own financial lives. And we speak about it in terms of helping them to make themselves a priority in their own financial life.
As Kate Leiprint, we've been talking with her, Managing Director of Baldwin Financial Advisors, and Bobby Kincaid, President of the Central. She's a Central Region Chair. We've been talking about her investing. Annie Logue is also with us. And Annie, I wonder if we're thinking about, just about going back to the whole idea of being on solid financial footing, what's the first thing you think let's think about for young female listeners to think about?
I think one of the first things that they should think about, just basic financial issues. One is managing debt, because young people often do have a lot of debt. They might have student loans. If they have to buy a new car, furnish a new apartment, get clothes for work, those are things that often lead to people having debt. And it does tend to be somewhat higher for women. Just things like women's clothing and the kind of clothing that women
are expected to wear to work. They're expected to have more outfits. They're expected to have nice purses and makeup and grooming, and that can add up. So I think one of the first is paying attention, making sure that the debt you have is manageable, and working on a way to pay that off. I think I would add, in a way, make sure you're registered to vote, and make sure when you look at candidates to think about how their policies affect your pocketbook. I think a lot of people have, in recent years, assumed that the candidate who pushes for lower taxes is the one that's best for them financially, and that is not always the case. So, you know, to think about that. I think that if your employer has a retirement plan, contribute to it, because those returns compound over time. Like Bobby said, with her investment club, their goal is to double their money every 5 years, and that's not a ridiculous assumption. And if you start contributing to your employer's retirement plan at an early age, even a small amount, and you start letting it compound between the age of 22 and retirement, it can be real money. And I think that's something people should really pay attention to.
Oh, there's so much more that we didn't have a chance to get into, but I'm afraid we'll have to have this conversation again. I want to thank Kamaya, who just tweeted, yes, we need to have these conversations. All of you on Twitter can suggest more specific topics. You can always email us as well. Our email is talk@21stshow.org. But we'll have to pick up this conversation at a later time. But I want to thank Bobby Kincaid. I know, Bobby, you're headed off to Chicago for a National Better Investing Conference this weekend. If people are interested in learning more about groups like yours, we'll tweet out your website. But I want to thank Annie Logue for also being with us. She teaches, she's a lecturer at UIC and author of a number of the books in the Four Dummies series about finance and investing. Kate Leiprandt is managing director of Baldwin Financial Advisors in Arlington Heights. Ladies, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Isla Boodoo. We were just talking about personal finance, how women are often treated differently in conversations about spending and saving. But when it comes to paying monthly bills, most Americans have their biggest bill in common, and that's housing. In recent years, more and more U.S. households are renting. In fact, there's a higher percentage of households renting at any point in the past 50 years. That's according to 2017 data from Pew Research. There are many ways policymakers can try to keep rents affordable. There's one policy tool that hasn't been an option because it's been banned in Illinois and 36 other states, and that's rent control. Some advocates, including Democratic State Representative Will Guzzardi, say it's time to lift that ban and allow local governments in Illinois to enact rent control laws. Others say that's the wrong approach to affordable housing. So rent control isn't allowed in Illinois. Do you think it should be? You can text us. Our text number is 217-394-5765. Save that in your phone, 217-394-5765. We want to hear your thoughts on this. Representative Will Guzzardi is actually joining us now from Springfield. Hi, Representative. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by Michael Meany, the head of a coalition called Shape Illinois and the executive vice president of the Chicagoland Apartment Association. Hi, Michael. Good morning. Thank you for joining us as well.
Good morning. I'm happy to be with you.
Representative Guzzardi, I wonder if we can start with you. You proposed a bill earlier this year that would have lifted the state ban on rent control. That was voted down in committee, but there are a couple of others going on in the state house. Can we just start by asking what problem you think you're trying to solve by removing a ban on rent control?
Yeah, it's a very real problem that people in my district are facing all the time. In fact, there's a group of students down here in Springfield today, and I just talked to one of them, and he said, you know, my family was renting a three-bedroom apartment for our whole family. We were paying $800 a month, and it's in a neighborhood in a part of Logan Square that's changing, and the landlord decided that he could get more rent out of the apartment than we were paying. So the next time we went to renew our rent, he charged us $1,200 a month. and we couldn't live there, and so we had to leave the neighborhood. I had to leave the high school that I was attending. My parents had to commute farther to get to work because we weren't close to the train. And that's not a one-off story. That is the story of tens of thousands of families in my community and tens of thousands more across the city of Chicago. So the problem we're trying to solve is that landlords, the city is unable to provide any cap whatsoever on how much landlords are allowed to increase their rents. And so some unscrupulous landlords out there are doing precisely this, raising their rents by a ton, basically engaging in eviction by rent increase in order to turn over their properties and get wealthier renters in there. And that has caused tremendous displacement across our city.
Representative Guzzardi, do you think this is a problem just in Chicago? What about in the rest of Illinois?
No, it's absolutely not just a problem in Chicago. And that's why, you know, I've been working with colleagues in a number of other cities across the state as well. You know, we've even heard from some folks who live in or represent tenants in manufactured homes in parts of central and southern Illinois who are facing very similar challenges with the owners of those homes.
So,
no, it's a statewide problem for sure.
And to your mind, who then should have the power to decide where and how there would be rent control laws? Do you think that should be up to municipalities?
Well, this is just it. Yeah, I think that the state has this ban in place, which in my view just makes no sense at all. I think cities are the place where we make these decisions all the time about landlord-tenant relationships. Those are governed by city law. And so the cities across the state of Illinois ought to be able to consider this question and to look at all the models that have been out there in municipalities across the country and across the world and say, this seemed to work, this didn't seem to work, this was a good tenant protection, this wasn't, so here's the policy that we want to devise. And if they look at this question and say, we don't want to do anything to cap landlords' ability to increase rents, then so be it, then they won't do anything. But this decision properly belongs at the city level, and that's why we believe that the statewide ban should be lifted.
Michael Meany, I imagine you have a different perspective on this. You think this should be a ban, and maybe you can explain a little bit more why?
I do, yes, thank you. You know, first of all, I'd like to just remind people that I'm representing the SHAPE Illinois Coalition, and that stands for the Support Housing Affordability, Progress, and Equality for Illinois. And, you know, first of all, I'd just like to acknowledge that, you know, We do acknowledge the an affordable housing challenge in Chicago and in other parts of the state, and we certainly want to be a part of the solution. So we agree with Representative Guzzardi and others with regard to that issue. However, we have a fundamental disagreement, I think, about how. At least in one policy on how to address it, and that is rent control. We think that, and evidence has shown that rent control is a policy that doesn't work. The unintended consequences are, and the downsides are such that we think that the state ban that's currently in place should stay there, and that it should be the public policy of the state of Illinois. To not allow for rent control, to explore and to emphasize other ways to provide affordable housing, but that that rent control really should be a non-starter.
So, Michael, when you say it doesn't work, how can you explain how you think it doesn't work?
Sure, there are only a handful of states that currently allow for rent control, and the evidence in areas where it has been enacted. And you know, almost all of the studies that have been produced have demonstrated that that it doesn't work in the extent that in the long run it actually reduces the supply of affordable housing because investors pull out of the market. Home builders, apartment builders do not build new apartments, and we need it really is an issue of supply and demand. So what we need to be doing is encouraging the development and the building of more affordable and market rate housing, and rent control as a public policy has the exact opposite effect. It's been shown to, as I said, discourage investment, so you have less construction. The housing that does exist, because there are limits or caps on rents, investors and the owners are not able to make the proper investments that they need. So the properties fall into disrepair, and owners end up walking away from the properties, or they convert them to other uses. So again, you know, the economics of rent control have proven to not work, and that's why we think that it is it's good policy to keep the rent control preemption in place, and to explore other options which we are fully engaged in.
Representative Guzzardi, I wonder what your response is to what Michael is saying, because there certainly many economists don't like the idea of rent control because they say precisely what Michael's saying, that it incentivizes landlords, for example, to take units off the rental market. Perhaps it keeps people in larger units they don't need because it's a unit they can afford because of rent control. Is that something you're worried about?
Yeah, you know, the research is actually somewhat less conclusive than Michael suggested. And in fact, the one really conclusive result of all the research around rent control is that people who stay in rent-controlled apartments end up paying less for rent, right? And that is the outcome that we're seeking here. And the research is very clear on that front. The effects on the broader housing market at large are complicated and hard to gauge because it's difficult to sort out sort of causality. Although I will say that recently Toronto expanded its rent control protections to new classes of units and then saw a huge rental boom, a boom in rental construction. So the idea that when you pass rent control, it's automatically going to mean there's going to be some sort of diminishment in supply, there's certainly plenty of cases in the real world to bear out that that's not the case. Let me just also add that Michael brought up the question of supply, and I think it's important. I don't think that I or anyone else would say that rent control is the silver bullet that's going to solve all of our affordability problems. I think it's very good at protecting people who are in affordable units and making sure they can stay there. But I also do believe, and Michael and I have been working together on an initiative to I believe in the construction of new affordable housing as well. And I think that we have to be investing in building more affordable units for families who can't find anything today. So I think that these approaches need to be taken in tandem, and they need to work together to create an environment and an ecosystem where people can find a place to stay that they can afford.
That's Representative Will Guzzardi. We're also speaking with Michael Meany. He's head of this coalition we've been talking about called Shape Illinois, as we're looking at how to keep housing affordable. And in particular, we're talking about rent control. And Michael, I wonder, I think that both of you are obviously going to disagree about what research exists, so maybe we should set that aside. And I wonder, to Representative Guzzardi's point just about rent control can perhaps help keep long-term tenants from being evicted, the situation he was just explaining of the student that he just met that in Logan Square, whose family's rent went from $800 to $1,200 as this Chicago neighborhood becomes more popular. What would you say to a family who says, I think rent control is the only thing that would keep my family from being evicted?
Well, like I said, and I don't, it's difficult to dispute the assertion that if someone rent is not increased, then that's not going to help them stay in their home. That's obviously the case. The challenge with rent control, again, is the longer term policy impacts. Where rent control has been enacted in other parts of the country, there are so many different forms of it. It's really difficult to talk about it holistically, but it's typically targeted. So you will have there will be some residents that will be subject and covered by rent control and some that won't. So it really creates a system of winners and losers. Obviously, the people that are covered by rent control are definitely going to see some benefit in the short term. Our concern is, again, the longer-term negative policy impacts that rent control has. And that's why we think that we need to do everything we can to address the affordable housing in ways short of rent control, because it's just going to lead us down a path that we're going to find ourselves in a worse situation down the road. So Representative Guzzardi indicated that we're working together on some initiatives, and I do want to commend him for for sponsoring a resolution in the House that calls for including funding of affordable housing in a capital bill that the General Assembly is working on. So, you know, we would propose that, as you suggested earlier, that maybe we set the concept of rent control aside and really concentrate on...
Well, that's not what I said. I actually said you should set... I said that you should stop talking about the research of it because I think both of you are going to disagree on that. But, Michael, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about what policies you think you would support when we're thinking about affordable housing, what policies the SHAPE Coalition is working with Representative Guzzardi on?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mentioned the resources in a capital bill for affordable housing. There was limited funding for a capital bill, for affordable housing in a capital bill back in 2009. We're calling for, and Representative Guzzardi's resolution calls for a significant increase of up to $1 billion for affordable housing in a capital bill. We also are supporting, and I believe Representative Guzzardi is as well, legislation that was introduced by State Representative Sarah Feigenholz here in Chicago to create tax incentives for property owners who either invest in existing units, so, you know, they fix them up, or they build new units. If they agree to keep the rents affordable, then they can get some property tax relief. And we think that policy will be particularly effective in neighborhoods that are seeing increasing rents and are experiencing gentrification and displacement. So this would entice landlords, instead of investing in units and then increasing the rents significantly, they would be able to keep them at an affordable level because of the tax incentive.
Right. Representative Guzzardi, as both of you are talking about this, Michael is also executive vice president of the Chicagoland Apartment Association. Obviously, you represent a rapidly changing or gentrifying neighborhood on Chicago's north side. I want to ask both of you, we're discussing a bill that would affect the entire state of Illinois. And so, Representative Guzzardi, what's your pitch to other parts of Illinois? Why should a listener in a more rural part of the state, or in a smaller city like Champaign or Rockford, why do you want them to consider supporting this bill? What do you think housing affordability problems are out there for smaller cities across Illinois?
Yeah, I think that Champaign's actually a really interesting example because the university is creating a lot of upward price pressure on housing, right? They're doing a lot of buying up a lot of properties and renting it to students, and the areas adjacent to the university are seeing similar effects that we're seeing in my community of rental prices being pushed up. So it's definitely not a problem that's unique to Chicago. There are renters in every town and city in the state. And I believe that those towns and cities have the right to protect the renters in their communities from the behavior of the most unscrupulous landlords who might want to push them out of their house to make a profit. I appreciate Michael and SHAPE Coalition's work on affordable housing, and we're working to secure capital dollars to build more affordable housing. I think it's interesting that that they've expressed such support for Representative Feigenholz's bill, which I think is basically conceding the premise that rent control is a good thing for renters, right? That we want to incentivize landlords to control rents for the people who live in their buildings. I agree totally. I think that premise is exactly right. We should make sure that rents stay affordable. And we need something with a little more teeth than just a property tax incentive. And that's why I think that this should be implemented, and municipalities should have the choice to implement this across the state.
Representative Guzzardi, we're almost out of time. Just very quickly, have you spoken to Speaker Madigan or Governor Pritzker about this or similar proposals in the General Assembly?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, I spoke with the governor about it during his campaign as well, and he has committed publicly to his support to lifting the ban on rent control. And I know a group of activists met with his staff last week and are continuing to work to meet with his office and figure out how best we can facilitate a working relationship on this. And yeah, we had a setback this year in committee, but we are still pushing, and we're
and obviously the conversation will continue as well. That's
yes,
Representative Will
Guzzardi.
I want to thank him, Democrat from Illinois' 39th district in Chicago, Michael Meany, head of the SHAPE Illinois Coalition and executive vice president of the Chicagoland Apartment Association. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With the weather starting to warm up and summer on our radar, baseball fans throughout Illinois finally have something to look forward to. With the Cubs leading the NL Central Division, the White Sox improving on a kind of abysmal start to last season, it's a good time to go catch a game. But controversy involving Cubs infielder Addison Russell still looms large over the Cubs season. He returned to the lineup last week after a 40-game suspension for violating the MLB's domestic violence policy. He's already back in the headlines for how he's responded to Cubs fans upon his return. Last week, Russell made his return at Wrigley. The Cubs blog Rooftop Rundown recorded some of fan reaction from the stands. Well, here's how it sounded.
Number 27, second baseman,
as always, Cheryl Raystout has been on top of everything sports-related in Illinois. She's on the line with us now to give us an update. Cheryl, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
So, Cheryl, as we're thinking about last night being Addison Russell's first game on the road, right, after his return from this suspension,
yes.
I wonder, you heard the audio from his first home game back. How have fans been responding to Addison Russell over the past week or so?
Well, I was at the park for all those games, and actually, the boos were a little bit louder over the weekend when he was playing. So, he was not in the lineup last night on their first road game with him. It's going to be interesting when he finally is on the roster on the lineup card.
Okay.
So that's going to be different. But I will share with this when I was there the first game. They have the big scoreboard, and it shows the different players, you know, working their positions at, you know, center, right, left. They didn't show him when he was on the field, which I thought was very interesting.
Mm, and, I mean, that's a big – I mean, those new scoreboards, well, they're not – I guess they're not that new, but I think they're new. The Bills are – I'm. That's obviously – people are paying close attention to that. Cheryl, I want to bring up something that Addison Russell said, which is also part of this, which is he said – if Cubs fans, quote, want to boo someone that's trying to help bring the team a World Series again, then that's on them. And then on Friday, he said that comment wasn't meant to be critical of fans who boo them, who are booing him. And he says, no, I have nothing but respect for the fans. How much is this situation kind of getting a little, it sounds like almost he's exacerbating things a bit.
The problem is he says something, then there's pushback, rightfully so. Then he has to correct it. You cannot inject common sense to somebody if they don't have it. And that's what this team's trying to do, is to massage, you know, his situation day by day. And I asked him about, look, you're going to be facing this every day. When you go on the road, it's going to be worse. And he, you know, he thinks he can handle it, but we will see, because
I mean, he hasn't handled it very well so far, Cheryl.
Not. I mean, there's times where he sounds like he sounds very scripted, but no, you're right. Overall, he doesn't know how to handle it, and I think it's going to get worse when he is on the road in some of the other cities like Philadelphia, New York, or, you know, some places like that. The other thing is he's not playing, you know, he's not hitting, he's not done anything offensively. So if his stats don't improve, it's going to be interesting how much more the booing will be here in Chicago.
Right, because it's obviously that's the other part of it is if you're not playing well. But and we're thinking about this whole issue of domestic violence. Cheryl, yeah. I wanted to just ask you about the MLB protocol, because we saw also Dodgers pitcher Julio Urias was also just arrested on suspicion of domestic battery. Do we know how, can you explain how the MLB is supposed to handle this? And do we feel like people are satisfied with the way this is being handled right now?
Well, they have their policy, and with Addison, it was 40-game suspension. It goes by a case-by-case basis. But the problem is what do you do at the end of that suspension? And the Cubs, they had that quandary, we can't put on the major league roster right away because he hasn't played. Do we keep him down? Their choices were A, keep him with the team, B, release him, or C, trade him. And so I think the other issue for that, now that's what they could have done, those three scenarios. Their problem was that they had nobody in their minor leagues to back up a Javi Baez as a shortstop. So for a baseball decision, they kind of got stuck in that rut.
Right, because they needed the infielder. Right.
Exactly. So that was all a baseball decision, because the other issue was that Ben Zobrist is on personal leave. So that makes it kind of difficult. Again, baseball decision. As far as the league, they make mistakes all the time with this. They, sometimes you don't think they know what they're doing. I will say this about Theo Epstein, the vice president of the Cubs. He is trying to do his best, and he's talked about it a lot. He is part of the process of trying to help Addison Russell and his former wife. They actually, from top to bottom, everybody in the organization has had to learn about domestic violence, the causes of it, the signs of it. So they're trying to be kind of like the sample team of what you're supposed to do if this happens to your club.
So, obviously that's going to put the Cubs in the spotlight. When we're thinking about how fans are responding to this, other than booing Addison Russell, Cheryl, how much are people talking about this?
Well, it kind of, as anything with sports fans, it's in their minds for at the beginning and then it fizzles out. But I will say, I do know that there's a lot of fans that will not buy tickets. There's a lot of women that will not buy tickets. There's going to be an impact at some point, but the team, again, I have to, split hairs with this. The team is winning. So we're not, and we also have had bad weather. So you don't know what's
right. How much of it is the rain? How much is the cold? Okay. So let's get
exactly.
to the base.
How much is it Addison?
Right. So let's get to the baseball side. We were talking about the not baseball parts of baseball with Cheryl Raystow, WBEZ sports contributor. But the Cubs are on the road today in Cincinnati, right? They are actually first in the NL Central right now. What are prospects for hanging on to that spot, Cheryl?
Well, they have won every series since the beginning of the week, beginning of the year. They've won 8 straight series. Their starting pitching has been stellar. I mean, beyond stellar. They're giving up the fewest runs of any team in baseball right now. So that's their positive as far as that goes, because that was shaky at the beginning. The other thing is Javi Baez has been magical at shortstop. He is, he's hitting .325. He's got 11 home runs. Wilson Contreras is also hitting a high average, and he also has a lot of home runs. And you've seen that Chris Bryant is finally back to where he was a few years ago as far as his hitting. So there's a lot of things working for them right as far as on the field. They're winning games that they should win. They swept the Cardinals 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, and then they took 2 out of 3 on the division rival Brewers. So they're on pace to do things well. They're on pace to what they were like 2016. But
are you allowed to say that, Cheryl? You don't want to
say it.
You're saying it. Okay. So let's.
But things can change. You just have it. You have an injury. You're like, what happened last year? They played really well till the All-Star break, and then a lot of the players kind of wore out, particularly the kid behind the plate, Wilson Contreras.
Cheryl, let's go across town then and ask you about how things are working for the Sox. You were at Guaranteed Rate Field yesterday, right?
Yes, I was. That was a blowout. Yeah, it's a team that there's a lot of good things going on for them. They're hovering on that .500 mark, which is probably where they're going to be most of the season. They've had some injuries with their starting pitching. Carlos Rodon is going to have Tommy John surgery today. He will be gone all of this season and part of next season. Michael Kopech, who he had his Tommy John at the end of last year. What you're looking at the White Sox is seeing improvement with some of their players. One, Tim Anderson is really playing very well defensively. He steals bases. He hits, he's been hitting home runs. He's also an exciting player that is really pushing the buttons when it comes to the old man rules with baseball. And then you got Johan Moncada, who is really producing well. I mean, there's these glimmers of hope with some of these players. Lucas Giolito. He's had a couple of really good starts. He's 4-0 this year. He's got a below .300 earned run average. He's found it. I talked to him yesterday. He said, I know what I have to do. Not if it's emotional or, you know, it's mental what they're trying to go through. So these players that struggled last year because they were young and hadn't gone through a full season have now got that behind them and they're moving forward. And the one good news is that a couple of days after Eloy Hernandez comes back, we'll see if he can produce more as a rookie.
All right. Well, that's a little bit about baseball with WBZ sports contributor Cheryl Reistout, at least about the Sox and the Cubs. Cheryl, thanks for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Anytime, Nyla.
All right, we were just talking about baseball. Maybe if that's not your thing, a great summer day at the zoo might be, including a stop to see roaring lions, playful penguins, grazing zebras. And now, throughout the summer, a visit to the Brookfield Zoo near Chicago also includes a different type of animal, life-size ones made from Lego bricks. Brookfield Zoo patrons will be able to see 40 different sculptures, which are part of the new Brick Safari exhibit. Everything from full-size elephants to leaping dolphins, tiny beetles made from millions of Lego bricks. They are on until the end of September. In the meantime, Andre Copeland is on the line with us. He's the interpretive programs manager for Brookfield. Hi, Andre. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
And so when we're saying life-sized, is the elephant really life-sized?
Well, the elephant is pretty much life-size for an adolescent African elephant, not quite
not an adult
for
one.
An
okay.
Adult male.
All right.
And so, almost there.
How many bricks are in something like that?
Well, the elephant, for example, is comprised of 271,000 Lego bricks. And took over 1,600 hours to assemble that one sculpture. And like you said in the intro, we have over 40 life-size sculptures for people to enjoy at Brookfield Zoo.
And were all of them constructed at the zoo, Andre?
Unfortunately not. We would have loved to see that, but in order to get the entire exhibit together, it took close to 8,000 hours. So the sculptures had to be put together off-site. They were shipped here, fully assembled, and then put into place.
And where are they? Are they all throughout the zoo?
They are at one area that's on the southeast side of the zoo, right behind the Wild Encounters exhibit. So when people come to our zoo and they enter through our south gate, they can take a pathway just to their right and they'll run into the Brick Safari. We're really excited about Brick Safari being here, and it's presented by Metro by T-Mobile and helps us talk about our belief in putting the A into STEM education.
And when we're thinking about those arts and kids, Andre, I wonder how children react when they see them. I imagine this is maybe not something they're expecting to see when they come to the zoo.
I don't think they're expecting to see something as visually creative and awe-inspiring as the sculptures that they see. I mean, when you think about children playing with Legos, they are expressing themselves creatively and they are putting together things in a similar fashion. But when you see what the Bright Bricks designers have done with this experience, it's something that at least takes my breath away. And we've had many photographers come in and be just as delighted as the children who go through the exhibit. I've talked to people that are budding photographers, and they said that there is just so much for them to focus on, so many good shots for them to take, that it is a photography artist's dream. So it appeals to children, but it also appeals to adults as well.
Andre, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite of the sculptures of the 40 different ones?
People keep asking me that, and I love the King Cobra. The King Cobra is one of my favorites because I love it when artists depict animals that have scales in a way that helps people realize they're just as beautiful as the animals that bear fur.
Interesting. And are these professional Lego designers who built this?
Yes, they are. Bright Bricks has the only certified Lego building company in the UK. So people think of careers such as architecture as a vocation where you just draw blueprints and build buildings, but you can put those design skills to use in a company like Bright Bricks, designing and assembling Lego those sculptures and bringing them to organizations like Brookfield Zoo to help people understand the tight connection between art, science, and nature.
That's Andre Copeland, who's the Interpretive Programs Manager at Brookfield Zoo. This Lego Brick Safari exhibit is actually on until the end of September at Brookfield. Andre, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. Playing tunes on my guitar, swimsuit, summer dress,
playing on the beast of best, skim milk, white bread. That does it for us today. Speaking of animals and photographs, tomorrow we are going to be speaking with famed wildlife photographer Thomas Mangelson to talk about a new retrospective exhibit of his photos. You can always go to 21stshow.org for more information about us. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Apostin is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow. Tomorrow.